In Houston History Magazine's issue entitled Dredge to Excellence, 100 Years of the Ship Channel, that was published in 2014, Debbie Harwell writes, "Since its earliest days, the city has acted as a magnet for people coming here to look for work, particularly in jobs associated with the ship channel and the burgeoning industries along its banks. Whether building the railroads to transport goods to and from the port, loading and unloading the ships that called here, or navigating vessels and barges along the waterway, the people, the Houston workforce, have made this economic engine successful." This is Amy Bachari, and you're listening to Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. Through recording, preserving, and educating, our mission is to share the impact of engine-powered vessels, their crews, and their passengers with future generations. To learn more about our organization, visit sshsa.org. After World War II, with Japan and much of Europe in ruins, the U.S. economy grew significantly, and this economic boom also affected the Port of Houston. Cotton, grain, petroleum products, vehicles, and other goods were in demand, and the port's tonnage figures reflected this. As demand continued to grow, so did the need for labor.
A friend of mine in New York told me, if you're looking for a job, you need to go to Houston because they're calling up here all the time looking for people. So I took him at his word and came to work for Strong Shipping Company down here when I first came down.
So what was your initial impression of the Port of Houston when you came down?
Well, I enjoyed the people. I liked the Texas people, and the longshoremen were easy to work with, you know. But that was another strange thing that, I don't know, did you run into that? But they had white longshoremen and black longshoremen, completely independent of each other. The whites had their own union hall, and the blacks had their own union hall. Not only that, but then they had what they called warehouse locals who worked only in the warehouse. They didn't work on a ship, but they unloaded the trucks or whatever and put the cargo in the warehouse, and then the longshoremen took the cargo from the warehouse, put it on the ship, or vice versa. So you're dealing with two white locals, one a warehouse local and one what they called a deep sea local, and a black warehouse local and a black deep sea local. And you had to keep peace with them too. You know, they didn't like each other. They didn't try to work together. And so we fought that for years. Never able to do anything about it until the locals merged. You know, they all merged together finally. If you ordered a gang, one gang, you did not know whether it was going to be black or white. They talked about that at night. Well, this is our turn. We'll take this ship. You take that ship, this ship. And so we were obliged to order what we called a walking foreman. He's a straw boss, you know, a walking foreman, but he's union. So we had to order two walking foremen, one black and one white, because we didn't know whether we were going to get a white gang or a black gang. So when the white gang showed up, the black foreman went home, and he made a day's pay, a walking foreman.
So berths 1 through 8 on the west side was the long reach operation.
That was, yeah, Anderson Clayton.
And then the first Port of Houston berths were on the east side, and those were all union run.
Yeah.
And those were not as efficient as the long reach.
Oh, no. Right. You had different steamship companies putting the ship in there, all fighting for a berth. This was all run by Anderson Clayton. They told you what you could do and what you couldn't do. When you got on the north side, you just had to try to make the best of it.
Now, my understanding of a union is the purpose for joining a union is to get better pay and to get better benefits for the workers.
Sure.
Did you ever hear complaints about the employees on the Long Reach docks about low pay or
all Mexicans?
They were all Mexicans. Is that right?
Never heard, but efficient Mexicans. Yeah. I mean, they've all been with Long Reach. Long Reach kept their people forever. Mm-hmm. Once you get a job at Long Reach, I mean, that was a sort of ambition of people living in the East End to go to work at Long Reach.
That was Captain William Robb, who was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, and went to sea at 16. He served in the Merchant Navy for the United Kingdom during World War II. After the war, he married and came to the U.S. to live and work in 1949. He had heard that the Port of Houston was seeking stevedoring superintendents, and he and his wife relocated to Texas that same year. He spent over 50 years working in the stevedoring business. Captain Bill passed away in 2013. He spoke with Jason Terrio in 2006 for the Houston History Project at the University of Houston Center for Public History. They spoke about World War II, union troubles, and race and labor in the port during the peak days of breakbulk cargo. If you missed our last episode, go back and listen to episode 19 to learn about the history of the Port of Houston and the Houston Ship Channel.
And where are you from, sir?
I'm from Edinburgh, Scotland, born in Scotland, and emigrated to the States in 49 and moved right on down to Houston, where they were desperately looking for superintendents at that time. They just didn't have any.
Growing up near the ports,
yeah,
and near the water, did you have an early interest in maritime?
Yeah, and then when they had a nautical college in Leith,
okay,
for trainees for master's license and chief officer's license and that. And when we were at school, we used to go down there and, you know, they would always, guys willing to talk about ships and the sea, and it was right in the port. The nautical college was right in the port. So we'd go down there and visit the port and visit the ships. And I did that for a long time. And then before I decided that that's what I wanted to do was to go to sea.
About what time? How old were you?
15.
Okay.
Yeah. And I went to sea at 16.
Okay.
And had a year in nautical college.
And what year was that when you were 16?
38.
Well, they let 16-year-olds go out to sea, huh?
As an apprentice, yeah.
Okay.
You sign, and you know, you have to sign articles as an apprentice, and it's a 4-year contract that you have to sign as an apprentice. And then, of course, the war broke out. I hadn't been to sea a month, and the war broke out, and everything was scrapped and forgotten about then. So it was just every man for himself after that. And we never had enough people. They never increased the crews on the ships. They increased the watches. You know, we did four on and four off, four on and four off, indefinitely. And normally on sea, you do four on and eight off. Well, when you're young, it didn't make much difference, you know. But looking back on it, it was just ridiculous to try to keep those hours that we kept all the time. And sometimes in bad weather, it would take over 3 weeks to get from, say, Liverpool to New York. In convoy, because the speed of the convoy was the speed of the slowest ship. And when we'd be doing 3 or 4 or 5 knots, you know, in a whole day, we may not do 100 miles. It was unbelievable. Mm. And then you just, four on and four off, you could imagine by the time you got to New York, which is like this, you know. It was dreadful.
Well, at 16, that must have been quite an adventure for you.
It was, yeah. But all the cadets started at 16. So we did everything. Everything the sailors did, we did too. Well, of course, that was all cut short by the war. I was able to take my second mate's license when I was 19. They cut that back a year just to get more people. They didn't have enough mates with the war and building all the new ships. So that helped a whole lot.
Tell me about, if you can recall, sir, about finding out that the war had broke out. When did that take place for you guys in Scotland?
Well, I was in Liverpool on my first ship. That was when Neville Chamberlain was going back to Germany and whatnot. We didn't really feel the effects of the war. That line I was sailing with was Blue Funnel Line, and they sailed to the Far East. So we continued running back and forth to, went to Japan and went to China and Australia, and that went on until Pearl Harbor, and then all that happy time was over. Then that's when there weren't very many places you could go without getting in trouble then.
What type of cargo were y'all transporting in those early war years?
In the early days, it was just regular commerce. You know, we weren't carrying any war materials. We were carrying tea and coffee and all the things that you carry back and forth from the Far East, from China, and that went on for a couple of years. And then, of course, everything started to change when the war got worse and worse. It turned out you were carrying nothing but war material after that. Well, after the Far East closed up, most of the sailing, was, of course, was in the Atlantic, so it was just back and forth, endless. I met my wife on the North Atlantic because she was a passenger coming from New York to London. So we met, and I called her when I'd get back, and we finally got together after the war and got married and moved to back. Thought we were going to move to New Jersey. She lived in New Jersey. Her parents lived in New Jersey. But I couldn't stand that weather. That wintertime, we got there, and wintertime was awful. Trying to drive in slush and snow. And so when I heard about this job, that there were jobs available, and there was no jobs available in New York anyway. I'd already tried that. So, and she was quite happy about moving, so we moved down here.
Had you ever made any trips to the Port of Houston before 49?
No. My first trip was by air when I came into Hobby Airport. That was the only airport here at the time.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning, sir, that you had found out through a friend that the Port of Houston was desperate for supervisors. Mm-hmm. Now, if we're talking 1949, that's post-World War II. There was a lot of activity here in the port. Obviously, the petrochemical industry was booming and emerging. Why do you think they couldn't find any supervisors?
Well, I don't know if they couldn't find any. I guess a lot of people that did it during the war did it because they had to. It was common knowledge in New York that their Texas ports were looking for people. And seemingly so, because when I came down here, half of the superintendents that were working in Houston were from the east, northeast. And in fact, the one I worked for came from Boston. It was Strawn Shipping Company. He was a captain, Captain Nick Scully. And all of those different, there were so many new stevedore companies. It was a strange situation. They had no stevedore companies as we would understand them in New York, where you had big stevedore companies that ran half a dozen piers. There were no stevedores like that down here. The only stevedores in Houston worked for a shipping company, like Likes Brothers. Likes had their own stevedores, but Likes wouldn't stevedore another ship, and States Marine had their own stevedores, and all the American companies had their own stevedore company, but not, I don't know whether it was anything to do with their government sanctions. You know, the steamship companies got a lot of money from the government just to operate, and I don't know if that conflicted with their, but they wouldn't like stevedores. If you had a ship next to a like ship, they wouldn't consider even giving you labor or anything else. So the little stevedore companies started to handle the ships that were coming in that were not liners like States Marine or Likes. Captain Baker was Likes. And they had their own stevedore companies and their own people and their own equipment. And back then, there was no equipment in Houston. Likes were the only people that had forklifts. So everybody else was using hand trucks and stuff like that. And it took a while to get organized just to come down. I went to work for Strawn, and Strawn didn't have a forklift. So here we are. We had three or four lines. They had signed up for three or four lines just because they didn't want to. It looked like it would have been better and cheaper to have branched out and did more, but none of them would do that. So they worked only their own ships.
So a stevedore company, when hired by a shipping company to either unload or load cargo from the ship to the docks and vice versa, the stevedore companies are those who go to the union to find the longshoremen.
Yeah.
So the stevedore is the middleman.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And but there was a lot of, I didn't run into it, but there was a lot of bad feeling between management and ILA. Mm-hmm. Not so much the stevedores as the steamship lines. You know, they just couldn't believe the price of anything. You know, they were making millions because they were all subsidized, but they fought unions. They just fought. They fought the seamen's unions too. But It was interesting to be in the middle of it, and because I was independent, I was on everybody's side. But
How did the rates compare? The longshoreman rates and the shipping rates. How did that compare from Houston to New York, where you had been working before? Were they comparable?
Well, yeah. Because New York was like nothing else in the world. You know, it was mafia, and you know they even checked your bags when you came off the ship. Not the customs, but the mafia would be sure that you didn't have anything they wanted. And they patrolled the docks. They just, it's unbelievable how they, you know, guys in big cigars and fancy suits, and he was a head honcho up there. You didn't dare say a word to them.
Different kind of straw boss, huh?
Yeah, straw boss, yeah. But all expensive suits and stuff like that. Different world. We never ran into that here. Well, our big problem was the constant war between the whites and the blacks.
The race relations.
Yeah. And I got along fine with blacks and whites. In fact, in one case, I'd only been here a few months, and I got involved in I was working a ship that had loading grain, and she changed from AFL to CIO, Union. One of the crew that was on board was told they had to leave because they had hired a new crew. The ship changed hands, and the new owners belonged to this nautical union. So we got in a big fight. I say we got in a fight. The crews got in a big fight. The one didn't want to leave the ship, and the other crew had been sent up from Galveston. One was AFL. And so they got fighting on the dock. Really fighting. I mean, with bicycle chains and God knows what else. So the one guy came to me and he said, we want you to stop loading this ship. I said, well, how the hell did I get in this mess? You know, we were almost finished with this. We're loading grain. And so I can't stop. He said, well, you better stop, you know, because you're in big trouble if you keep on like this. And then these guys were really bloodthirsty. They fought and, I mean, really banged each other top of the head. So I didn't know what to do, and then nobody could tell you what to do, so I just kept on working. And when the ship finished, it was dark. So they came and told me that when you leave this ship, you're in big trouble because we're going to beat the shit out of you when you get off the dock. So I didn't know what to do, and I'm telling these longshoremen, I said, well, what the hell are we going to do? They weren't bothering them at all. I was the only outsider. So they went to the union hall and told the president, who was Bud Laird, and he was a tush hog himself. And they told him that, you know, I was in deep trouble. So they sent a bunch of longshoremen from the union hall down to the ship and told these guys, hey, this guy is one of us, and you better not lay a hand on. So they waited there. I had to papers to get signed and all kinds of things to do. They waited for me, and I didn't know them, you know, but I really appreciated that. I could have been in big trouble. So from then on, you know, I got along fine with them.
Now, did you guys give preferential treatment to one union group or one specific gang or another? Was there one gang that y'all worked more closely with?
No.
Or is really who was available at that
time? They had about 40 gangs in both locals. And some of them were dreadful, you know, horrible. You just hated to see them come down the dock because they were so slow, you know, and you could tell that they were not going to do anything, and then you couldn't fire them. It was a hopeless situation. You just had to do the best you could. It was really horrible.
So, now, as a supervisor, your job was to watch over the loading or unloading of that ship, yeah, with this particular gang.
Right. And you had to do it exactly the way that the chief mate on the ship wanted it. You know, he wanted this stowed here and this stowed, because he was thinking about discharging it. So he had to have it available when he got to Algiers or wherever he was going, that all the Algiers cargo was right where it needed to be. So this was hard to explain to longshoremen because they just put it in there. But you had to keep it segregated, separated, and of course different types of cargo. Couldn't be close to other types of cargo. The odor or something might spoil it. It was a complicated business. And of course, when you're working with a foreign ship too, then you had to get the chief mate approval of everything that you did. And then you had to go back and see that the longshoremen did it that way. And of course, they had their own way of doing, they wanted to do the easy way.
So in 49, in the early days, right after the war, what was some of the main cargo that was being transported up and down the ship channel?
Food, mostly.
Yeah, grain?
Well, a lot of grain, yeah. And oats and stuff like that going to Europe. Well, we loaded grain day and night. It was a big, big, steady thing. And then we dealt with the U.S. government on that. They were the, it was a giveaway cargo. So they had superintendents, too, that came from Washington to come down and supervise this. Some of them never seen the ship or grain. And that was interesting, too. We had to get their blessing before we could do anything. But grain worked day and night. It was a busy, busy thing, grain. Sometimes these ships would be loading for 15 or 20 ports to discharge in 15 or 20 ports. So it had to be laid out perfectly. You know, it had to be laid out so they could get it when they needed it, not have it buried somewhere and then have to shift other cargo to get to it. So they were very, you know, and of course I had sailed as a chief mate, so I knew what their problems were. But I know they had a lot of problems with some stevedores who didn't understand that. They thought all you had to do was put it in the ship. They weren't going to be in Australia somewhere where you were trying to get it out. And that was one reason that I went with Strawn, because they had Bankline, and Bankline was not very happy with Strawn stevedoring. So I got along fine with them. And I was, that's a Scottish company anyway. They were from Glasgow. But they were very fussy about because they went to Australia and New Zealand and had a lot of union problems over there with longshore unions and stuff like that. So they had to get it, make it as easy to discharge as they could make it, you know, just a constant, it was a worry for them all the time. And the longshoremen didn't understand that, you know, they would throw it in there, get it in and sail the ship.
So how long did you work as a supervisor?
I started with Young & Company in 53, and I think I became a vice president about 61 or 62 or something like that. So I was I still worked ships as a vice president, because we had special lines and special people, and always had people from out of the country coming to visit their ships and stuff like that. So you had to be there when those people showed up. Then we got Volkswagen contract, and that was a big contract, and that when they first started, I mean, it was not a roll on roll off business. You had to pick the cars up, you know, with a derrick and put them on the dock one at a time and not scratch them or not do any damage to them. And that was a hectic trying to break longshoremen in to do that. To treat anything gently was, you almost had to have a pistol, but they got on. And of course, once the drive off came, it was just easy money after that. Built those ships, fantastic ships. Some of them carried 3,000 or 4,000 cars. Just amazing. Everybody's office was in Longreach. Okay. This was where all our business was. And it was a horrible place to work. The ceilings were only about this high because it was designed for cotton. I mean, that was hand truck cotton. It was not designed for any kind of forklifts. So when you worked, when they started forklifts in there, you couldn't breathe. I mean, there was no ventilation, just low little warehouse, you know, but it went, they made millions of dollars out of it. It was a busy, busy place. Ships waited on berths to get in there. And they made it their business to be, well, they're very efficient. They worked night and day. They were non-union. They had no longshoremen. So they had people working day and night, unloading cargo and getting it ready for the next day, sail a ship today, and they'd work all night, putting this cotton into the berth for the next ship.
Wow.
No longshoremen at all. No union.
So they were working efficient, faster, overtime.
Yeah.
Now, what about over here at the Port of Houston? These were all union?
These were union. All union. All the port was union.
This is where you had some of your race troubles and some of your troubles with these gangs.
Yeah, you had to know a long time ahead of that, because you had to start putting your cargo in there. Mm-hmm. So that meant you had to have somebody over there to unload it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people avoided that as much as they could because it was inconvenient. You had to send somebody over there with a forklift, have a clerk over there. So if you could do all this at Long Reach, you'd sit in your office, and we had our office there too. Everybody had an office. All the offices were here. This was a hub of the Port of Houston.
So it was kind of two different sides of the railroad track, so to speak.
Right, exactly.
Two different worlds, really.
And then very efficient. And then they were always willing to help. They were anxious to move cargo, and that was their business. Very efficient. That was just when pallets were being introduced to. They set up a pallet plant, and they started making pallets. Mm-hmm. They made pallets day and night. Mm-hmm. They always had plenty of pallets. If you came to the Port of Houston, you had to go look for pallets. You know, and they didn't have any of their own. You had to steal pallets from somebody else. It was really an imposition if you decided to put a ship in there. Mm-hmm. It cost you money from a stevedore's point of view. You had to have somebody to receive the cargo on a daily basis, you know, because somebody in New York wanted to know, have you received this, have you received that? So you had to go over there and check it out, see what you had, and report it. Whereas here, this was just one clerk could take care of all your ships here. You put one in, the berths were just numbered 1 through 8. Mm-hmm. And then you would tell you were going to berth 7. Mm-hmm. So then, you could handle everything from, we had our office and our clerks in the office over there. And if we had something on the north side, we had to send a clerk in a car over there to do that.
And so has this setup, has this changed today?
Well, this is gone.
Yeah.
I mean, the berths are still there, but I think they just put these laid up ships in there. Now, there's no stevedore activity at all.
Mostly operated by cranes now, huh? Containers.
They had a heavy lift crane too, which was unusual. This is where you had to go if you had a heavy lift. You had to go there whether you wanted to or not, because the port had no heavy lift cranes. They had a what they called a stiff leg at that time. It just sat on the ground, and mm-hmm. but they could lift 30-40 tons. And so if you had a heavy lift at all, you had to send it to Long Reach and then squeeze the ship in to get it. You had to be right. You couldn't move the crane. The crane was fixed. So that was a big deal when you had to go with the Long Reach and load a heavy lift. And we had a couple of pretty long strikes too since I've been here, and it was just unhappy for everybody. It was not good for the longshoremen, and certainly wasn't good for management. And we argued about some of the silliest little things, you know, just unbelievable. We used to meet in Galveston. I was on the committee, the negotiating committee. No air conditioning. Go down there to the Union Hall, where we meet in the Union Hall in Galveston, sweat just rolling off everybody, and trying to get some kind of contract put together. New York would send them, this is the minimum, you can go and then elsewhere, whatever else you can get it. So that initially, we sort of agreed on the money. You know, it was only, at that time, $2 and something an hour or something like that. And that was kind of set up, look nationally, but then there'd be these little things that, you know, and we'd sit for weeks talking about things that of little consequence, but they were so determined that they were not going to back up, and our people were determined that they were not going to give in. And of course, the big steamship companies like Likes, they can sort of held the club, you know, they didn't like longshoremen anyway. And they didn't like unions, and so they balked, and it was so obvious from the start that we were going to have to give something to get organized and get the labor that we wanted and get some of the things that we wanted. They were a very frustrating time, and then weeks would go by. We'd travel to Galveston every day and meet and talk about the same things we talked about the day before. And then,
so you think that the big strikes empowered the union?
Oh yeah, without a doubt.
To be able to confront management and the private sector and force them to make certain concessions.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was really a turning point for the longshoremen and the unions in that respect.
Yeah. Over the years, and nowadays it's quite different. The ILA works hand in glove with management now. They realize, I think both sides realize, that not only the longshoremen got smarter, but I think the owners got smarter. And of course, there's no American steamship lines involved anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, they used to have a light ship in here every day, or two or three a day. And they ran to the West Indies and back, and they'd be back in 10 or 15 days, and they always went to Long Reach. So there was always, Long Reach was a busy place, sometimes three or four light ships. I think the harmony made them realize that, you know, if they could just keep harmony, then they would make more money. They may spend a little more initially, but you know, the whole idea is to keep the thing running. And eventually it worked out that way. It took a long time. But the American companies took over the negotiations. A little company like, I was young in company, and we didn't own any ships, but because they felt like since they owned the ships too, and they were the ones that were suffering, if they would depend on we as a stevedore, didn't suffer other than just not making any money, but they were paying crews and ships laid up and stuff like that, and they were the ones that were just so difficult to. It made you wonder what it was. Just the idea that they were in charge and they were not going to give in to the longshoremen. Of course, all the rest of the people at the negotiations, like me, who worked for little stevedore companies, that we were all for getting back to work.
And what has happened to those ship companies, Captain, in your opinion? Where have they gone?
They're gone. Well, nobody went to containers, for one thing. American flag were slow about containers. You know, the Germans came in with these barge vessels. I don't know if you've seen those. And they carry barges, 82 barges, North German Lloyd and Hamburg America Line. And they jumped at containers, you know, likes fought against containers and didn't fight against them, but were not, they didn't think that was the answer to their problem. And then they didn't build container ships. And everybody else in the world was building container ships as fast as they could build them. And obviously that it's been a success because everybody's got the containers now. But these States Marine and Delta Line and the about four or five American companies that came to Houston. I mean, if you got a container to put on board, it was a big operation. You know, they didn't go to any container berth. They wanted to drag that container down to Long Reach. Then they had to shift the ship down to that heavy boom they had. And they just put themselves out of business, it seemed to me.
How did the oil and gas industry change all of this?
Oh, I think that was the making of the Port of Houston, was the oil and gas business. They got ships and they started making commodities like carbon black and stuff that, you know, made from oil production. Carbon black was a big thing here. Hundreds of thousands of tons went to all over the world, to Europe and Australia, shiploads. And it's, of course, I'm sure it still does, but it's in containers. It was a messy cargo to handle, you know, just black suit and paper bags. And just the combination of that and cotton in the same warehouse was, the cotton people just completely couldn't understand how anybody could be that dumb. But at Long Reach, there was nothing else. You had to do it. Ships were coming to Long Reach, and they had carbon black and cotton all in the same ship.
Now, some of the guys at the ILA mentioned about this this 50-mile radius law, I guess, if you will, restrictions that didn't get passed, and the longshoremen fought the containerization because that took away a majority of their business right there.
Well, they thought it did, but it actually brought them a lot of business. They never could understand that. I mean, we were loading containers and unloading containers, and that went on for years. We argued about that, in fact, we were on strike about it one time. But somebody has to load these containers, you know, from our point of view, or unload them if they come in loaded, you know, so that's longshore work. They get that work, too. Of course, it's nothing like the money that they get. They get double the money at Barber's Cut. If a longshoreman's got a few years seniority, he's not going to work anywhere else. He's just going to work at Barber's Cut. So the newcomers coming in, still getting those jobs of unloading bags out of containers and putting them on pallets and stuff like that, or vice versa. So that work will always be there. Somebody's got to do it. And they're taking them into the union. But they're not getting any jobs at Barber's Cut, that's for sure.
If Malcolm McLean's invention and his idea really took off in the late 50s and really began to emerge in the early 60s.
You know, the first ship came to Houston.
That's right.
Yeah.
The petrochemical and the oil companies had already established foothold in this area. Is it possible that the reason why containerization took off so quickly from Houston is because of the infrastructure that the oil companies had laid down in the ship channel?
Quite possibly, yeah.
Thanks for tuning in to Ship History Radio. We hope you enjoyed hearing Jason Terrio's interview with Captain William Robb. To learn more about our organization, visit sshsa.org.